is being turned upside down with the advent of social media. Our next speaker is eminently qualified to talk about this. Meg is the Director of Community and User Experience at The Guardian in the United Kingdom. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Experience, for helping her to come all this way and be with us, and we're delighted that she's here to talk to us. Let's welcome Meg Picard.
Hello, thanks very much for having me and thanks for the introduction. So I'm going to be talking a little bit about big media owners and what, how do we create and stimulate community participation and interaction around content objects. The reason I kind of want to make that distinction is just because sometimes, you know, we think about community as being an end in itself, and actually quite a lot of the time, especially if you're working in the media, you're really talking about how to make media social rather than how to make social media. Which is something that we're going to have to sort of look at. So first of all, I just want to kind of say, my slides aren't here. There we go, that'll do. Whew, moment of panic. So first of all, you know, I want to talk about how users interact with content. Basically, we're all really used to the stuff that happens up the left-hand side. You know, users consume content, they read it in new and interesting ways sometimes. They read it on mobile devices, they read it on, you know, RSS readers. They don't read it on your site, but they do nevertheless read it. Consuming content is a very old activity, and it's something that's been around certainly, you know, for 300 years in terms of newspaper printing or printing generally, and much, much longer than that if you think about cave paintings. So what we talk about when we think about consuming is creating experiences which are essentially passive. You know, we, the publisher, create something, and you, the reader, the audience, just consumes it and enjoys it, and, you know, it's very passive, it's very lean back. Sometimes it's even lean back on the sofa, glass of wine, you know. I mean, it doesn't require any interaction from you. Then we start getting a bit more active, and users, you know, in the last, well, you could even say probably the last 50 years, reaction has started to become more important. So anything from letters to the editor to comments on a site to voting and reviewing and rating is ways that people can look at a piece of content and then turn around and actually say, yeah, but I think something different, or actually I think that's a really good point. In fact, most journalists would prefer that the response was, yeah, that's a really good point. In fact, yeah, that's a really good point, have a Pulitzer. It tends to be the thing that most journalists are holding out for. But the thing that I'm most interested in is the stuff that happens towards the right-hand side, stuff that is harder for users to do, because the stuff on the left-hand side is easy for users. There's not much not much effort required. The stuff on the right-hand side is actually much harder for users. And in some ways, it doesn't seem fair that it's also harder for publishers. It's harder for publishers emotionally because they need to really change the way that they think about content. And it's harder for publishers technically because they need to build and design systems that that make these objects or these activities worthwhile. So first of all, I want to talk about curation. Curation is, I think that's going to be one of the words that we look out for and that we hear an awful lot about in 2009, especially around media objects. We're going to hear much more about people not just having your say about a particular story, but stringing stories together in new and interesting ways. Users stringing stories together in new and interesting ways to create whole new contexts, to tell their own stories, to tell stories in new ways. Hands up anyone who's seen an Amazon Lists, you know, the thing, List Mania. Right, so you've seen it. It's when you go onto Amazon and you're looking for guidebooks about New Zealand and suddenly a list appears on the left-hand side of the page that says, you know, here are 10 great things if you're planning a trip to New Zealand. And this is a list that's been put together not by a marketing agency, not by New Zealand Tourism, although, you know, some of it I'm a bit suspicious about, but actually by users who are passionate about their subject, passionate about the idea, and have an awful lot of knowledge, and are basically drawing from a defined set of data, everything in the Amazon catalog, and putting it together in a particular order, 1, 2, 10, to say, here are things that you need to buy. If people can do that with Amazon lists or with objects that you can buy in a bookshop, then I'm really interested to know why they can't do it or why, you know, how we can help them to do it on newspaper sites. Actually being able to say, this is what we think the definitive stories of 2008 were, or here are the best political speeches ever made, according to me, and I know my stuff. And actually then when we move to the far end, you've got this idea of creation. I mean, Derek talked before about making things easy and making lowering the barrier to entry so that people could participate. And actually, creation is a really interesting side of that, because what we mean by it is, how do we get people to actually not just respond to the news or respond to media objects, but actually to create them themselves, but in such a way that actually retains quality, which is ultimately the thing that we can have to be concerned about as a media owner. So this is something that I have, this is kind of my bugbear that I bring to these things, which is often I go into organizations and big and small, and they talk about social media as if it was completely the same thing as social networking. Social media is not social networking, they're not the same thing. This is probably blindingly obvious to everybody in this room, and for that I congratulate you. But first of all, when I see a media site that looks like a bunch of content and then a big arrow that says, and if you want to talk about it, you have to go into that room over there, that's like a content experience and then a social experience that's bunged on the side. The two don't really fit together, they don't contribute to each other, and they don't actually add anything to the experience. So this is kind of, I used to work for AOL, I'm okay now, but I used to work for AOL, and back in the heady days of, the mid-90s, we used to have a community channel. And this is very much what I think of as a community channel. It's, we'll create the content. Don't you worry your pretty little head about the content. We're the professionals doing that. And if you want to talk about it, well, that's where the plebs go. I don't think we ever used the word plebs in our user experience, but the sentiment was there. And in fact, social media looks a whole lot more like this. Social media looks like a content experience that is enhanced by and added to by the social experience, content that gets better because people are using it. And in fact, the fact that people are using it makes the content better, but also that the experience gets better because of the content. So it's a symbiotic relationship between content and the fact that people are using it, which is really exciting if you're a publisher, and it should be exciting, and much more so than just this library is full of wonder and exciting and really interesting topics, but if you want to talk about it, you can't, which is what often newspapers tend to look like. We heard an awful lot about content is king, and content is this big thing, and certainly 10 years ago we were all saying content, it's all about content. The more content we have, the better an experience is going to be. I disagree. Content isn't king anymore. Context is everything. Context is what helps us to weave stories together. Context is about creating platforms, creating topics, and then bringing in some content and some social activity and various other different aspects in order to tell a story in new and interesting ways. So, in fact, at The Guardian, this is what we start to, this is how stories start to get put together. We don't just think about some text and then we'll bung some comments on the bottom of it. We actually think instead, what is the context? What is the story that we're trying to tell? And what are the most appropriate means to tell that story? Sometimes it's going to be about text, which is, our bread and butter and what we've been doing for a very long time. Sometimes it's about multimedia. Sometimes, doing that video interview or an audio interview or telling a story through a soundscape is actually going to be much more effective than having somebody describe it for you. And then there's data journalism, which is something that, we're doing an awful lot of work on, as are lots of other people, which is how does data help to tell that story better? Sometimes it's about providing raw data. Sometimes it's about parsing it, about displaying it in ways that actually help to further what that message is. And then, of course, social. Social, which you could think about as community, but is how do people and the act of people help to actually make this story make more sense? So it's not just stick comments on the bottom of it. It's also a good example would be something like a story might be put together with data, a combination of data and social activities. And there is no text and there is no multimedia, but simply people reporting different activities of what they see in their local area or what they have experienced actually starts to make a story. One story, one individual's response isn't a story. Hundreds of people's responses actually starts to make patterns. And patterns are what stories are made of. Patterns are something that's worth noting. So this is something that we're kind of a model that we're sort of using at The Guardian to think about. It's not just creating very static objects that we then fluff up on the sides. It's actually thinking about pages and stories being put together through contexts that are important. I know this is a bit early in the morning and I'm standing between you and lunch, but here's a pop quiz. This is the bus stop where I get the bus to work in the morning. This is how we do it in London. We all queue up very nicely. You see, we're well trained. And I just want a pop quiz. Hands up if you think this is a community. Okay, a few. Hands up if you don't think this is a community. Okay, hands up if you don't know what a bus is. This is something, okay. or what queuing is, in fact, for that matter. We'll find out at lunchtime. This is really interesting. I mean, the answer to this, as is the answer to many things, is maybe. Maybe they're a community. They're a potential community. They're a latent community. They have got a lot of stuff in common. In fact, what they've got in common is, you know, they all live in the same area of Southwest London. They all share a time, so they're all kind of on their way to work or on their way to a particular time at a particular moment. They all share cultural norms and a shared cultural understanding. And I mean that because they understand how important it is to queue. And it really is important to queue, I should just point that out. And if you've ever seen anyone trying to push in, you would know how important it was to queue in that bit of London. But, you know, so they share an awful lot in common, but what they all have a relationship, but the relationship they have is not with each other. The relationship they have is with the bus stop. So basically, they are, you know, the first woman putting on her makeup, she's thinking about the bus and she's relating to that bus. The man is relating to the bus. The red coat woman is relating to the bus. That sounds kind of dumb, but when you think about the bus stop as being an article and this list of people being a list of comments, actually this is what often community looks like on a lot of sites. It's a bunch of people who have got so much in common, but they're not actually interacting with each other. They're just interacting with the object at the front of the queue. They're interacting with the article and not with each other. So one of our questions is, how do we actually start to stimulate? How do we get interaction going? How do we get people talking about stuff with each other and not just, you know, kind of saying, me, I think this, well, I think this, and I think, you know, it's actually getting them to talk to each other, not just about it. Controversial statement. Social media does not need to be sociable. In fact, Derek mentioned, he had a great line there before in his presentation, which was designed for selfishness. And this kind of strikes the same chord, you know, which is actually social media, most of the time, is really about anti-social media. It's about individuals doing what they want to do, and then the fact that there is a social outcome at the end of it is awesome, but that's really not why they're doing it. So people tagging things on Delicious, it's because they want to save their bookmarks. People tagging their photos on Flickr, as Derek mentioned, it's because they want to be able to find them better, or they want a very small group of people to be able to find them better, you know, their friends or whatever. It's not because they want to do something out of the goodness of their heart for the whole of humanity, which would be lovely, but it's just not true. So I think this is a really good example of, you know, social media. This is a path through a forest. This is what London looked like when I left it last week, kind of. You know, and this is, how do we know where the path through the forest is? We know where it's gone because lots of people have gone there before. But they might not be the right people. We don't need to know who they were. We don't need to know that John was the first guy and he's 44 and he likes cheese. And then we don't need to know that, you know, Samantha went later and that, you know, she's 38 and she's got a cat. I mean, we just don't need to know this stuff. We do need to know a few simple things. We need to know, first of all, that they're not suicidal lunatics all running to jump off a cliff. Because if they were, then we wouldn't want to be following this path at all. And second of all, we need to know that they're all moving in a direction that is interesting to us or that makes our journey slightly easier. So the fact that people have gone before makes our journey easier because, first of all, we might need to make less decisions. Second of all, it might make the ground a bit flatter. And third of all, because we can choose to ignore it, because we can see where people are going and actually then make other decisions around that. So it's not just about the wisdom of crowds. This is about lots of individuals. I doubt very much that this was a stampede. This was lots of individuals over time adding to an experience which ends up having a social effect, ends up being better for everybody, but only as long as you parse it in the right way. Second of all, social media doesn't need to be complicated. Quite often we think about social media as a kind of a black art, you know, this sort of, get social media consultants in who will do voodoo magic on your site and they will make everything perfect. And the truth is that actually social media tools, the best social media tools, just as Derek kind of mentioned before, are the ones that are really simple. The propositions and the tools that are incredibly simple and straightforward are often the best ones to use within this context. So simple social media building blocks include things like the ability to react and participate. So comments, polls, stuff like that. Doesn't need to be complicated, can just be text, doesn't need to be, you know, WYSIWYG or anything like that. Attention data, the ability to see what other people are doing and to surface that information, to see what's hot, what's not, what's new, what people are talking about, those kind of topics. Profile data, the ability to aggregate your stuff and stick it so that you're carrying your reputation around with you like a backpack wherever you go on a site. And the ability to communicate with each other, the ability to reach out and actually start to make those bridges, to start to have that conversation in the queue rather than just all constantly waiting and looking at your watches waiting for the bus. Controversial slide to put up. I posit that even though trolling is a bad thing, and we heard a lot about trolling before, I think it's absolutely okay to heckle. Do you know, you all have heckling here, please don't demonstrate it right now, but you all understand the concept of heckling, and here's why I think heckling is a really good idea. And in order to tell you about it, I'm just going to have to do the wibbly lines thing and take you, first of all, to the other side of the world, to a place called Dundee in Scotland, which is not too far from where I'm from, which is a very famously radical town. And Dundee in about 1780 to about 1910 was famous for three things: what they called jute, jam, and journalism. Jute is kind of it's like flax. It's the thing that you use in order to make linen, to weave linen out of, and I'll talk about more about that in a moment. Jam, you probably know about. They also make very good cake up there. And journalism. It was one of the hotbeds of journalism in the UK, where people were actually starting to create lots of independent newspapers, independent presses, and for some reason, partly because it was a big whaling port, partly because there was a lot of stuff going on there, it was lots of shipping, actually that's where stories were starting to get made. So what relevance does this have to heckling, I hear you ask? Well, actually, this is a heckle, and this person is heckling. A heckle is a comb that's made of wood with a bunch of nails stuck in it, and you get the fibers from flax, which is a kind of a plant, and you drag it over this comb again and again, repeatedly, and eventually it draws out all the impurities and makes it into something that is that is very easy to work with and that you can then weave into fiber, you can weave into material. So what they actually did is they would have rooms full of people, a heckling shop they called it, and they'd have rooms full of people sat at desks with a big basket of fiber beside them and big combs on the desk, working their way through as they just did this over and over again. It's incredibly dull, it's incredibly monotonous, and actually more than that, it's incredibly bad for your health because all of the fibers get thrown up and you inhale them and so on. So top pop fact for Webstock only, Robert Burns was a heckler. Robert Burns actually did this for a couple of years when he was in his early 20s, and he wrote about it in not very glowing terms and said, "This is possibly the most boring job I've ever done. Screw this, I'm going to become a poet." Words to that effect, anyway. He didn't like it very much. But the thing is about the hecklers is they would all sit in this heckling shop, and because it was such boring and monotonous work, they ended up, but it was so important to the creation of linen, which was such a stock trade in that area, that they would employ somebody to sit at the front of the shop and who would read to them all day long, and would read to them from the local paper, from the national paper, from books, from treaties, from, you know, would read to them about, you know, political manuscripts, all of this kind of thing, and would read all day long. And as a result, because it was such boring, monotonous work, these flax workers, these hecklers, became incredibly intelligent. They couldn't read. Most of them had no experience of, formal schooling. But actually, they became really well-read. They became well-read too, I should say. They became, they knew an awful lot about political rhetoric and satire. They knew an awful lot about the news and what was going on in the world. And that meant that in the heckling shop, as they were sitting there doing their incredibly dull work, they would start to have debates. "Well, that's a load of rubbish. That's not what he said yesterday. In fact, no, wait, this is a travesty for our industry." You know, they would argue with each other. And soon, they actually began to take those arguments outside the heckling shop, and they became incredibly notorious. In fact, they established a reputation as the most radical and stroppy element in what was actually a fairly radical town to begin with, which is saying something. By 1800, the hecklers actually controlled the local unions, they controlled wages, they controlled conditions and bonuses, which were mainly in the form of whiskey, so that was always good. And the heckling shop actually just became, they became notorious for turning up at political rallies. And when a politician was trying to do that, "Well, that's an interesting question, I'm glad you asked that," they would be the ones saying, "Excuse me, I think you said something the other week which I'd like you to..." No, answer the question, answer the question. Hecklers were about teasing out truth. Hecklers became really good at using wit and knowledge and experience and understanding of bringing lots of ideas together in order to make, in order to get stories told, in order to get people to tell the truth, in order to get people to, they would challenge in order to get good responses out of readers, or speakers. So actually, hecklers turned into, hecklers, although we think about heckling as being a really bad thing involving fruit, actually, heckling is a really good thing, and it's something that we as a newspaper organization are quite keen, cautiously keen, to encourage. I just want to make a note, though, that actually, you know, this is not heckling. This is just being disruptive. This is a troll. This is somebody who's just trying to, you know, because they like naughty words and they want to sort of be slightly notorious, or they like making trouble. Heckling is much more than simply throwing a piece of rotten fruit. It's actually about trying to tease something out and about trying to argue, and to do that in a constructive, witty, sometimes kind of forceful way. But I wanted to bring that into the room, because, you know, often we would talk about trolling as if it means everything, including disagreement. And it really doesn't. It means, you know, actually trolling is a very different thing from challenging disagreement, which I think is a very, very good thing, as long as it doesn't involve fruit. So one of the ways that we deal with this, and really that we deal with partly with heckling, but partly also with trolling, and all of these, and also development of community, is thinking about the holy trinity of community development. Basically, this is like it's like a tripod. You have to think about all of these aspects when you're creating or developing or managing a community. When you're thinking about what could people do to actually make this community better? Often in organizations, that means hire a moderation team, or get some moderation in-house, or put somebody in charge of moderation. Make it somebody's job to look after what the quality of user interaction on that site is. But quite often that turns into, do you know that fairground game? I don't know if you have it here. The fairground game, which is, you know, you've got a big rubber hammer and a box with lots of holes in it, and something pops up and you have to smack it, and then something else pops up and you have to smack it. We call it whack-a-mole. Actually, in community management, we call it whack-a-troll, but, you know, it's the same thing, where a problem pops up, you deal with it, another problem pops up, you deal with it again, and you just spend your entire time hammers flying, never actually managing to progress, because you're only ever going to be dealing with the issues. And one of the reasons that you're doing that, you've probably seen Super Nanny, that program where they send people to the naughty step. Well, that's sort of what you're doing. You're rewarding bad behavior with attention. I mean, I'm not a super nanny, but I can see that if you only ever sent children to the naughty step, eventually they would realize that the only way to get your attention is to be naughty. Sometimes in life you have to give ice cream as well as naughty steps. And there's lots of ice cream outside, so you can have that later. But, you know, so thinking about the human approach to managing a community is about reward and about, you know, noticing people, about encouraging them, bringing them on, and so on. And then thinking about technology as well. Technology, often a lot of, you know, big media organizations go, what we'll simply do is buy a copy of, you know, insert name of latest social software tool here, and then our job will be done and we won't ever have to touch anything. Technology is only as good as the people that are using it and the way that it is used. So, as we said before, sometimes you don't need something incredibly complicated. You just need something elegant and simple and well used. And that means it doesn't have to be the most groundbreaking of widgets. It can actually just be a blog system employed properly, or a comment system that actually has real functionality that people can use to comment really fast. But also some of the things that Derek again mentioned before, which, can I just say, it's been such a pleasure following Derek on this, because he's a long-time inspiration of mine. So it's great. I feel like just kind of standing up here and going ditto to a lot of his stuff. But the technology. So he mentioned the cone of silence and timeouts and things like that. All of these are things that you can employ technology to do to make an experience better for everybody. And so at The Guardian, we don't have what you call a cone of silence, but we think about we call it a bozo filter, I believe. We don't have a bozo filter, and that's partly because of The Guardian and the kind of approach that we have. We're a fairly progressive, left-leaning, liberal organization, and we just didn't like the idea of people, you know, having thinking that they were saying something, but we weren't really letting them say anything. We thought that that was a bit duplicitous for us as an organization, especially because we spend a lot of time talking about free speech and rights and so on. So we said, actually, it's very simple. We have a quarantine, and that means that if you behave badly, then your comments go into pre-moderation rather than into post-moderation. So, you know, we've used technology in order to make the experience slightly better. It just means, you know, if you are obviously an idiot and you're acting like an idiot, then we can put you in a little timeout, which still means that you can contribute, but it means that you get checked before you get involved in the conversation. But the most important thing, and the thing that I really want to kind of hammer home, is that human solutions to community management and technological solutions to community management are as nothing compared to the editorial side of it, compared to actually thinking about editorial, thinking about the proposition, thinking about why is it that this should be a community activity at all? What is going to make people want to get involved in this conversation? How important, how are we going to encourage them to do that? And what will we do if they actually do contribute in new and interesting ways? Because I can guarantee that if you you create a community or you create a community platform, but you don't really know why anyone would bother getting involved, then it's pretty damn clear that they're not going to know why they should bother getting involved as well, and they're going to feel that from you. So thinking about editorial and how it kind of wraps in, how editorial actually influences and creates that community is really important. So it's things like proposition, the framing of a debate, the tone of voice that we use, the reward, the interaction, and so on. In fact, I've put together sort of five things that editors can use, any editor can use, that will improve participation on a mainly editorial site. This is something that we're using at The Guardian, and I really think that this is, hopefully, kind of sums up what those five magic things are. These are not magic beans, though. You obviously have to sow them in the right kind of soil. You have to sow them in your own activities. The first thing is that we need to encourage journalists and editors to commission, write, edit, and curate for the web. That means that even if you're publishing things later on the web that were originally published in the print, you have to say that just because something is first of all a print object, it is going to end up on the web. That's certainly one of the big kind of paradoxes that we have to deal with every day. So rather than saying, is this a web thing or is this a print thing, we need to say they're all web things because they're all eventually going to be web things. So how do we make sure that we are building in the fact that it needs to have links in it? Needs to be, in a kind of tone of voice that encourages participation. It needs to be thought of as something that enables people to, it adds to the story, it adds to people's web experience, and it enables them to go further and to explore further. Secondly, we need to plan for and predict likely interaction. And by that I mean, we need to figure out what we think people are going to say in response to this. That doesn't mean, kind of managing it to the nth degree, but it does mean saying, do we want people to chip in with their experiences? Do we want people to just generally agree with us and give us a big, round of applause? Do we want them to argue? Do we want them to have their say in particular ways? Do we want them to have a debate amongst themselves but not with us? Do we want and are we prepared to get involved in that conversation if it starts to talk back to us? So actually, it's thinking about the kind of interaction means that we can actually pitch it better at our users. Means that we can, so a good example of that would be we write a blog post, we write an article. Do we put an extra line at the bottom of that article that says, this is what one person experienced when they last did this thing, so we now want to sort of hand it over to you, what's been your experience? In other words, do we set framing questions and actually start to try and influence the way that people participate? And that's really important because often, too often, it's have your say. And have your say just means everything from I agree with this article to this is not my experience to does anybody know, where I can find some more information about gardening? I mean, it is just, it's an empty box that just has lots of people shouting in it. So thinking about what we want interaction to do is really helpful when we're actually trying to encourage people to do it. Thirdly, participate and encourage participation. And by that I mean, actually participate yourselves. Eat your own dog food, if you have that expression. I don't have a dog, so I don't eat my own cat food. That's what I'll do. And by that I mean, you can't just say, well, we're the ones that are publishing the stuff, and then you're the ones that are commenting on it, so have at it. We're actually saying, no, you need to actually be as part of your community, because there is guaranteed nobody better to participate in a conversation, nobody better to influence a conversation, nobody better to actually move a conversation on or try and find topical links or actually start to pull a conversation together than the person that started that conversation in the first place. Far too often, we see journalists or writers or, not journalists, but actually writers, anybody that's creating stuff on the web, looking at participation or looking at web community as if they were, having a baby and then saying, I am a really good parent, but what they've actually done is have a baby and then walk away. Pushing the big red publish button is the start of the conversation, not the end of it. And that's something that we need to work, especially with journalists, to think about how we get them to understand that, that the commissioning and the writing and all of the subbing and everything that goes on is just kind of stage one of that story's lifeline. Actually, the rest of the story goes on after they've published it, and that's where people talk about it. That's where people are debating it. That's where people are bringing in new and interesting ideas. And the other thing is encouraging participation, which kind of feeds into my next point, which is recognize and reward quality contributions. Derek mentioned before, again, one of the things to do if you've got trolls is just to ignore them. But the converse of that is when you've got people who are adding quality, who are actually making really interesting and insightful points on your site, you have to recognize them publicly and reward them publicly. And by that, I mean, you know, it's mainly just rewarding with attention, but actually it's not enough just to say behind the scenes, you know, in your editorial meeting, you know, there were some really interesting comments on that thread the other day. Actually, we need to, you know, say to people, that's a really interesting point. Thank you so much for making that. Or when somebody comes in and says, well, I kind of slightly disagree with what you said, we can say, interesting, well, what do you mean? And how did, you know, tell us what you think. Not going up in fisticuffs against them, but actually finding ways to be part of that conversation by actually rewarding the right kind of behavior. This is, you know, anybody that's a parent will understand that this is, you know, what you do, you reward good behavior, and that actually strengthens the emotional and the psychological impact of that good behavior. People are more likely to do it if they think that they're going to get a cookie. Not actual cookies, I should say. And also recognizing it and rewarding it. And that also means doing things like this, which is actually listening to what people are saying, being inspired by what people are saying in the conversations, curating those activities, listening and following up and acting. And by that I mean, actually, how do we look at what the conversations are going on and say, using this information, using the conversations that have started to create new stories or to take stories in new and interesting directions or to feed back and say, here were some of the things that you had to say about this topic, or, you know, we said this and then this is what your response was. Finding ways that are potentially technological but actually are mostly editorial to actually go through and say, great comment, really interesting one, link to stuff, point it out, say, you know, Jim, 1969, had a great point in this thread. I mean, actually making it part of somebody's job to curate the conversation, not just to sub the page. So the thing here is, you know, actually, if you do all of these things, if you think about stuff as a web object, if you plan for and think about how you want people to respond, not just that you want them to respond, if you actually get involved yourself and encourage that participation, it doesn't need to be a big job, it doesn't need to be a full-time role, it can be something that is, you know, actually just 5 minutes of somebody's day, but actually looking in on the doors that you opened, looking in on the conversations that you started, acting as a host, not just a publisher. The way that I kind of often, especially in The Guardian, talk about this is it's like having a content site that's got lots of moderators on it, but nobody actually looking after the conversation. You know, they're all looking after trouble. It's like opening a bar and then hiring 84 bouncers. You know, their job is to look for trouble. Bouncers' jobs, I mean, lovely as they are, big as they are in most cases, their job is to look for trouble. Their job is to wander around going, is that guy a bit too pissed? Is he dodgy? Is she about to do something that she should? You know, their job is to look for trouble and then to act on that trouble and eliminate it. They sound like a sort of secret task force, but that's basically what they're there to do. Their job is not to look after the quality of the beer, or in fact buy the beer, or in fact make sure that there is beer. Their job is not to lay on some good music or make sure that people are dancing or to check in, see if people are having a good time, hand around the olives. I mean, that's not their job. And no. So my point here is, the only people that you're employing is people who are trouble watchers, and nobody that you're employing is actually looking out for hosting the conversation, being the host of the party, being somebody who can actually make sure that people are having a good time and reinforce those good times, then you're basically going to end up with trouble, because troublemakers are attracted to those who look out for trouble, just as fun and happy and excited and content people look out for those who are handing out ice cream, cookies and beer. Basically. So from that, I mean, this is my last slide, and really, you know, it's just to try and get people to understand that we see a very big difference between the idea of audience, this passive, this lean back, this, this potential community is great, but it's something that is kind of gone. We need to stop thinking about audience and also stop thinking about metrics in terms of measuring audience. You know, unique visitors or unique browsers is a lovely metric, but it doesn't really tell the full story. It just tells you that people might have jumped onto your site and then vanished again. It doesn't tell you what they were doing there or how engaged they were or how they were participating. So actually we need to stop thinking about audience, start thinking more about participants and how we grow participation. How do we actually get people to just do that slight leaning forward thing, to click something once on the screen, to actually start to leave trails of information and behavior on their site or on your site so that you can start to deliver better experiences to them, which then starts to unlock the doors to communities, because communities, and I mean that plurally, not singly. You know, community on your site, you will have many different communities, not just one homogenous lump of people, because they're the users, but the community is people who find themselves. And that's something that we really need to make a point of. You know, communities, you can't manufacture, you can't make them, you can't knit them together. What you need to do is find the things that people are passionate about, find those contexts, and find ways to create conversations around those contexts, and people will find each other. And once you've created, you know, you've added simple social media tools that allow people to communicate, to share information, to curate, and so on, then communities start to form themselves. So communities are not made, they're found, and they're supported, and they're especially done so by big media owners and small ones too. So thank you very much for your time. That's where you can find me. That's it. Thank you. And now I believe it's time for lunch now. So I think it's back in an hour for after lunch. Is that right? Yeah, good. Thank you very much.